Welcome to the Been There, Done That podcast with Angela Dunn Cartledge. Hi, everybody. This is the Been There, Done That podcast. I'm your host, Angela Dunn Cartledge, and I'm here with my good friend, my new good friend, Mark Stephen Poro. How are you, Mark?
I'm very well.
I'm so glad.
I feel like I've been drinking. I've been drinking a lot of tea, so it's very nice. I do drink a cup of tea.
That is excellent. That is exactly what we need. I would love to talk more about your book. Mark is an author of a book called A Cup of Tea on the Commode, right? And we are going to talk about caregiving, about grieving, about all of the amazing things that Mark has to bring to the table. And I can't wait to have this conversation. Mark, thank you so much for being here.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Awesome. I would love for you to take a few minutes to just tell us who you are, who you are and why you want to be here today.
Well, I grew up in a family of eight. So mom and dad were, I guess, pretty strict Catholics. They had six kids. So we were one of the smallest Catholic families in the church. Barely a blip on their radar screen, but the Catholic Church was a big deal for us growing up, and I may have strayed a bit, but it was a good foundation to have and stuff like that. And so both of my parents worked full time. My dad was a chemist, and my mom was a proofreader for the largest newspaper in New Jersey. So actually, both were pretty sticklers on grammar and spelling and stuff, but my mom had the eagle eye, so she was really good. But they were both very funny people, and they taught by example more than lecturing or anything like that. So we grew up watching them doing what's right, thinking about others, and being honest. And if several times I saw my father, if a waitress didn't charge for even like a cup of coffee, he would call her back over and say, "We got to correct the bill." And we just grew up doing that. And I've done that all throughout my life also. So it was a fun place to grow up, which was in Ridgewood, New Jersey. It was a small, they call it a village. It's 25,000, but it hasn't grown. We were there. Our family was there for like 65 years, and it's never grown bigger than that, which is great. So they don't build, enormous condos and any of that kind of stuff. And it's a suburb of New York City. So we had a lot of culture very close by, 20 minutes, or depending on traffic, could be 20 hours. But I have a chapter in my book called The Champion of the Arts. And that was my mom. She was really into the arts. And she would take us on jaunts into New York City. We'd go see a Broadway play or go to the Radio City Music Hall and see a new movie. When the World's Fair was there, we went there, and we went to see my, and so she was a big fan of the ballet. And so I have two older brothers, two older sisters, and I think all of them, maybe my older brother, not so much, but my older brother, one older brother and two older sisters were really big into the ballet. And so two of them were actually working with working with the Royal Danish Ballet. They were like little stars in New Jersey. And we had a very good ballet teacher. Irene Fokin was a very strict Russian ballet instructor and had a very reputable dance studio in our town. And so they were performing with the Royal Danish Ballet when they were kids in Lincoln Center. And I went to see them, and I'm in the dressing room, and it was one of these little Hollywood stories. Some guy bursts through the door and says, "Hey, we need another little kid to be in the show." And he locks eyes with me. I'm like six or seven at the time. And he says, "Hey, kid, you want to be in the show?" And I'm like, and he says, "And we'll pay you." And I went, okay, now I'm a professional dancer. And so I got rushed to makeup, and I got a great, I look like a little Errol Flynn. I got a little swashbuckling outfit, And I stood on top of this bridge with my brother and sister and a bunch of other kids. And we were supposed to pretend we're having the time of our lives, which we were. And on cue, we had to drop flowers down to the other professional dancers down below on the stage. And I was hooked. I said, this is great. So then later on, I was in Hollywood for 28 years. That first gig was probably one of my best paying jobs. It's terrible. It's a hard life. It's a hard life. Anyway, so then we started studying the ballet. And the studio was in, let's say, uptown. And that's where our school was. We all went to the parochial school. So after school, we just walked to the studio. And it was great because my brother and I were the only guys in the entire studio. So if you're into girls, which we were, it was like, this is heaven. And so that was great. And then I ended up retiring probably around 11, 10 or 11. I butted heads with Irene Fokine quite a bit. I don't know if it was a cultural thing or what, but I was a pretty strong-willed kid. And so we got into some issues. And so I left and did other things. But the arts were kind of, I think that's why I went into Hollywood, because that was kind of in my system. Once you get into that system of performing and stuff, it's pretty cool. So I went to Ohio State and got an industrial design degree and happened to work for one of the best design firms in the country. But the acting bug kind of caught me. And I went out to LA and stayed there for 28 years. I still did design because I didn't want to be a struggling actor or a hungry actor. I never waited tables, luckily, because I had my design background. So I did the design and then the acting. But the acting got me into writing because during the downtimes, you got to do other things. And I think because of my upbringing and the humor in my family and stuff, I was pretty good at writing jokes and writing funny situations. And then most of my training out there, I started training from day one because I wanted to be a good actor. I didn't want to be a flash in the pan or something. And so my original goal was to get on Hill Street Blues. So I moved out there in 84. And less than 2 years later, I got on Hill Street Blues. So that was my first gig in television. And once you get a gig like that, because that was one of the best shows at the time, that puts you at a certain level. So if you had that on your resume, that opened a bunch of other doors. So I had a pretty good run. I got a nice pension coming, which was a fun surprise from my work there. But the writing is something that I enjoyed more. I enjoyed the performing, of course, but the writing you have more control over, especially when you're writing a book. When you're writing screenplays and other stuff, there's too many people with their fingers in the pie, and it's just the horror stories. So that's where I cut my teeth, writing screenplays, really. And then when this incident happened with my mother, that was in 2011, I got the call that she was on her deathbed back in New Jersey, in the house that we all grew up in. And so that started this journey of me becoming a caregiver. But what was nice about that, I didn't know if you wanted to talk at all.
No, I love it. This is exactly what I wanted you to do. Just tell me stories, because you're so good at it. So yeah, keep going.
Well, thank you. So, but what was nice about that role, I had a really good relationship with both of my folks. I was a very curious kid. And I got them both to open up about things they rarely talked about or didn't want to talk about. And I don't know if my brothers or sisters ever asked the questions I did. But so I had a very unique relationship with both. And so when this thing happened, it was easy for me to make the decision to go take care of my mom because she deserved better. And working out the logistics took a little more time, but it was an opportunity that luckily I was able to want to do, but also to do. And so while I was there, I was conscious of, I always liked recording family history, and I was privy when you're there spending that much time with your loved one, you're privy to conversations and some jokes and funny moments and things like that the other kids weren't privy to. And so I wanted to record all this stuff. So I not only wrote down notes, but also a lot of photographs and a lot of videos of our time together. And so I wasn't sure what I was going to do with it exactly. I wanted to record it for the family, but then I had a couple of friends, being a baby boomer, all going to have to face this thing at one time or another. And so I had a couple of friends going through something similar. And so I shared some of the things I learned from hospice. So when this thing started, hospice was called, and my mom was kind of just shut down. And I called it a semi-comatose state, but it was self-induced. She was not happy, and I think she said, "If this is going to be my life, I'm out of here." And she just turned 89 at the time, and she suffered from depression at certain points in her life, but this was a good one. And so I moved back, and I think, so when we were first there, hospice was called. So my younger sister and I hung out with hospice because we didn't know how long mom was going to be with us. So we said, one of us always slept in the bed with her. And we learned all the tips and tricks from hospice. And so they let us do as much as we could, and they directed us. And at that point, my mom had bed sores, so we had to learn how to medically help the bed sores and how to change the bedding with the helpless patient in bed and change the diapers and sponge bathing and all that stuff. And also at this point, your loved one is fragile, so you have to know how to pick them up, get them in and out of bed. And when that happens, my mom didn't get out of bed for a few weeks. But so when I had my friends going through what they were going through, I shared some of the stuff I learned from hospice, and they got something out of it. So I said, I think I got something here. I think that a book would be the best way to share it and help people, because I always have ideas of making it into a movie or a TV show or something like that. And I still have visions for that. My writing is kind of like that, to make it very visual. But I thought the book is going to be the best way. And then memoir was going to be the genre. And I didn't know much about memoir at the time, other than I've read some, but so I started studying memoir. So whenever I begin a new adventure, I usually go and do the research, and then jump into it full, 100% and all that stuff. And so I studied memoir and took all the classes from my memoir teacher, who was Marion Roach Smith, and she was great. And I did that while I was in France. So we did that all online. And actually, she was my first editor. I hired her to be my first editor and got some great tips from her. And then I worked on the book, and I was fortunate enough to get a publisher interested, which is pretty cool for your first book. And also, I was in my 60s, so that stuff doesn't happen too often. So again, I think, when you make these decisions, at least with me, the world seems to support them and help out, whether it's serendipity or what. But it was, with my mom, I had very little issues doing that, especially with my siblings. I've heard all these horror stories about, oh, this sibling did this and this. It was, they all trusted me, and mom certainly trusted me. And once they saw her health and everything else improving, I think they trusted me even more. But so they backed off completely, and I was in charge, and it was great. So I was very lucky. When I say blessed, I was blessed. But part of it is my attitude, and part of it was certainly my family's attitude that very helped. And also, your upbringing, and so that was great.
Your foundation was so clear that it just made sense for you to be the caregiver. It made sense in the way that you tell the story, the way that your parents raised all of you. It made sense that you would want to be there and be part of that process for her, you and your siblings. But I'm saying that you, being my friend, I wanted to put you at the lead of that. But that's what I guess I mean, is that it was a natural tendency for you to take that on.
It was the right thing to do. And
Absolutely.
it's funny, because there are some people, hopefully they're not going to listen to this, that will not touch this book. I have friends who used to be good friends. They won't touch it. They won't say a thing about it. And a lot of them could be very helpful in Hollywood. And they have parents who are being cared for by I don't know who. And it just said, I'm not saying jump in and do this, but you may find some help in this book. If nothing else, it's very entertaining. It's a lot of fun. Mom, again, was a funny person. And I did ask for permission in the beginning. And I guess this is typical for my mom. So I said, Mom, do you want me to come here and take over and make sure that you're healthy and happy and safe? And she said, yes. And I said, okay, if I do this, that means I'm in charge. And she goes, okay. And I said, that means you must obey me now. And her mood completely changed. And then she puckered up for a kiss. I called her a kissing bandit. She loved the kiss. So she puckered up for a kiss. And I wasn't sure if that was a sign of surrender or one wishing me luck. So I gave her probably a kiss and hope for the best. And yeah, so that's how we started.
A little bit of both, maybe. A little bit
of both. Because she can be a piece of work. What I called a really good BS detector. And if that thing went off, she was trouble. But it was good. So one of my goals was to make Mom laugh at least once a day. And also, I have my motto. It may sound corny, but, you know, I've had a pretty adventurous life. I've done a lot of crazy stuff and, you know, given up a really good design career to go out and try to be an actor and things like that. But I always said, find the joy in it. And if you have that attitude, because there's so much negativity out there and so much negativity in a new adventure, if you want to focus on that and become a victim. But I choose to say, no, I'm going to find the joy in this. And of course, there's rough times and everything. I've started a bunch of, I call nonprofit businesses, and none of them were intended to be nonprofit. But I enjoyed, you know, starting something new. And give it your all. And if it doesn't work, you take that experience and you put it into the next project and see what happens. So when I jumped in to do this for Mom, because it's a stressful thing. I think you know, our caregivers, boy, they deserve all the support they can get. It's mentally, emotionally, and physically exhausting. And if you have a good attitude, it helps, and you need it. I would say red wine also is very important. But I was not, I was a carefree bachelor. I had no kids. I was never married, and so parenting was a whole new thing for me. And it was lovely to do that for your parent. You know, it's right out of the commandments: honor your mother and father. And it was people go, it's amazing what you did. I said, no, it's the right thing to do. And at one point, Mom did ask me, we had a rough day. And we had a few rough days, not too many, luckily. And she looked at me and she said, why are you doing this? And I said, because it's an honor for a son to take care of his mother. And she's like, it is? And that really hurt. You know, because at this point, we're probably a year and a half into this thing. Yeah. And I had to convince her that, no, this is so I had to come up with, you know, all these things off the top of my head. Oh, remember when you did this? Well, that was important. And remember when you did this for me? That was great. And remember when you didn't tell Dad that I was suspended for 2 days in school? Yeah. So this is payback. And she went, okay. But then you start thinking about it. And luckily, for me, it was an easy answer, because even during those rough days, and you have your mother who's, in her last years, and if you get her to smile or again, pucker up for a kiss, or having a witty comeback to some situation, which she had many of those, and that made it all worth it, or removed all the stress, at least for that day or for that moment or something. So. Again, if you focus on the positive and the joy of it, it makes it so much easier.
I love it. What do you feel is besides the fact that it was the right thing to do, what do you feel was the the catalyst that started all of this for you?
Okay, so what I get home, and your mother's on her deathbed. We had the priest come in and deliver the last rites and stuff, and I started looking around at what used to be a lovely, welcoming home, and that was no longer. There was no love in the home. Almost all her worldly possessions were sequestered into her bedroom. This was our house. It was a big 5-bedroom house, and so my mom's in her room with everything else that used to be around the house are all in that bedroom, crammed in that bedroom. It was hard. I couldn't walk away from that. And we would tell my brother, who was the point man, because he lived close and he was in charge of hiring all these people. So it was a big burden on him. He not only handled all the family finances, but he had to hire these people. And it's not easy because I went through trying to hire a caregiver before I took over the 24/7. Boy, those interviews, it's difficult to really get somebody you can trust and have any kind of faith in. And there's a funny chapter about that in the book called The Parade of AIDS. And boy, that was a wake-up call, because after those interviews, I said, I'm taking over. Nobody's going to do it better than me. And you can trust me and things like that. So, but that was it. And then once I started taking care of my mom, and even when my sister and other siblings were there, she perked up. And you could see that, again, I have a chapter in the book called A Silent Scream for Help. And that's what I think this was. She shut down. She wanted to be out. And we all came back and filled the house with love again. And she responded to that. And so, yeah, it was like she deserves better. And, if I can do it, great. If I couldn't do it, I would have to, supervise, because that was the beginning where I was supervising. And not everybody is cut out for this. We have the 6 kids. Two of them were hands off. They were not comfortable, which is fine, because if you're uncomfortable, your patient or your loved ones get a sense that and feel like they're a burden, and that's only going to make the problem worse. So they did other things. They took care of, like, one sister cooked. She lived about an hour and a half away, and she would come visit. She was like a little Susie homemaker, so she would make blankets and bring toys and things that she knew would cheer mom up. My other brother took care of the gardening and things like that outside, and also the family gravesite where my dad was very important. And when it snowed, he brought his plow over and did things. So you gotta do it whatever you feel comfortable in your wheelhouse. For me, there were no lines we didn't cross. I won't go into the details. They're in the book. People go, oh my God, this guy is maybe too honest. But you got to do what you got to do. And the acting and my design experience, because with design, especially with human-centered design, which is a big buzzword now, we've done this from my training in the 70s at Ohio State, if I may mention that, was one of the best design schools in the country. And whenever you're designing, you have to take the end user, or the audience, or the client who's using this product, or looking at the brochure, or whether it's a suitcase or a copy machine, how they're interacting with this thing. So you have to take that person, the end user, into consideration, and it's empathy. And if you have empathy for anybody, not only a design client or something, that helps. You've got to understand, you've got to put yourself in their shoes, see how they're going to deal with this. And then also my acting, because again, you have to put yourself in the character's shoes and really immerse yourself into that person. So once, when I took over, you have your 90, well, even when she was 89, you're seeing your mother naked for the first time. And as a son, that's not an easy thing. You see what the years have done to her. She had open heart surgery years earlier. Now she has a pacemaker in her chest. And gravity does amazing things.
Really does.
But I took on the role as caregiver. So I just said, I got to get over this and get on with it, because I have work to do. And so the design experience, the acting experience all came into play. And I was fortunate. I had all that stuff. I had those things in my back pocket, which helped this experience. But I think the lead of, finding the joy in it, and this is the right thing to do, helped everything else kind of fall into place.
I particularly love your perspective on allowing your siblings to have their strengths and bring their strengths to the table that was different than yours, obviously, but they were able to do it in their way and not saying, well, if I'm jumping in 100%, so do you. We all have to do this equally. There's not going to be any other way. And I think that, to your earlier point, plays into the dynamic that you had as a family. You allowed everybody to have their own strengths and to come into the process with their own perspective and their own ability to help in the way that they wanted to. It is just a really cool example to me of being able to love people where they are and allow people to participate to the level that they can. And everybody did. By default, by giving everybody that space, everybody did participate, and you didn't have any resentment, and you didn't have any of those situations where you had to think, well, she's not even helping. She's just all the way over there. She's not even doing anything. It was
Right. Yeah. Again, I was very fortunate with that. But also, I'm the tallest, so that had something to do with it. So, I had two older brothers that tortured me like cr crazy when I was growing up. So, the payback is still coming. I'm not sure when, but we'll see what happens. But also,
You have to.
both of my parents were very independent, and they raised six really independent people, and we're from Jersey. And if you know anybody from Jersey, we all have strong opinions and we have no problem expressing them. So I also write in the book, I said, it's probably best if only one Poirot's in charge because there will be friction will ensue. I think we all kind of went, okay, it's mom. So let's just have one captain in this boat and see what happens. So luckily, they all seem to have some faith in me. So,
Hey there, it's Angela from Been There, Done That. If you're navigating the wild, unpredictable world of grief, I want to invite you to something special. It's called Messy Mornings, and it's our free weekly newsletter filled with real talk, gentle reminders, and support that actually meets you where you are. Each week, I'll send you stories, reflections, healing prompts straight to your inbox. No fluff, no pressure, just the space to release, feel, and heal. You don't have to do this alone. Head over to donethatpodcast.com and sign up for Messy Mornings. It's totally free and it's made with you in mind. I've been there, and let's walk through this together. What would you say is your biggest piece of advice for somebody that is either on the cusp of needing to be a caregiver or already in it? What would you say is your is the one thing you would give them to take away?
well, it's got to, I'll do a couple. The first thing I would say is study, do research, talk to the pros. I was fortunate to have, the hospice people were very generous in sharing their experience with us. And there was no like resentment or like, what do you think you're doing? And they knew, they could sense that we really cared about mom. So they were very willing to do that. But the pros also say take breaks. You need to take breaks because the mental, emotional, and physical toll creeps up on you. And when my younger sister and I were first taking care of mom during when it first happened, we took breaks. We would go out and take a walk and. Neither of us had lived in our village for a long time, so we wanted to, go up and see if the deli was still there and things like that. And it was very important. When I took over full time, I said, "I'm a guy; I can handle this." And I put it, two important things. So when I first got back there, I wanted to return some dignity, not only to my mother, but to her environment. So she was, again, a little depressed. So I did a couple things for her right away. One of the things, the first thing was buy a new wardrobe. I said, if you want to cheer up a woman, if I may say this, at any age, a new wardrobe helps. But there is a fashion niche. I wish somebody would jump on this because I don't have time to do it. There is a fashion niche that needs to be filled, and it's attractive clothing for seniors. When I decided, because she had these drab day dresses, you know, at this point it was just a day dress and a diaper, and they were tattered and they looked horrible, and she looked like an old lady. And I wanted my mom to look better than this, and she always cared about her looks before and stuff like that. So new wardrobe helped, but I went out shopping for it. I went out to the mall and. You know, where I grew up, there's like five major malls. And I got creepy looks from people looking at a, you know, guy in his 50s looking for older clothes for a lady. And it was horrible. So that was not successful. So I went online and then again put in, you know, nice clothing for seniors, bed clothing, day dress and things, and got this the same stuff that I saw in the malls. So then I took the age requirement out and saw some very nice stuff. And at that point, my mom still had some pretty good looking legs. So I bought all these really, not super short, but short to show off her legs, and nice colors, pinks and blues and things like that. And I have one thing I said, and dare I say, sexy black. And she looked great in them. They were lovely. And so each morning I'd say, what do you want to wear today? And she, oh, well, I'll pick that one. It was lovely. So that was the first thing. The second thing was, she had six kids and worked full time. And she was a hand model when she was in her late teens and early 20s. So she loved her nails. They were like the crown jewels. They were long and natural. None of these, you know, onlays or whatever, fake stuff. So she went to the beauty parlor once a week when I was growing up, and she got a shampoo and set, and then had her nails done, and that was her treat. And when she would visit me in California, I would take her to my friend's Beverly Hills salon for the movie star treatment. And I knew she loved that. And it was lovely. And I don't know the last time she was at a beauty parlor or was treated well. Again, her hair didn't look great. She had no makeup and this horrible clothing. So I created a thing called Day of Beauty, which I tried to recreate the salon treatment at home. And so we originally did it on Sundays, but then being a good Catholic girl, she said, no, we've got to move this. We don't do this on the Lord's Day. And so I said, all right, if we want to avoid, you know, eternity in hell, I moved it to Saturday. And so I normally gave her two sponge baths a day anyway, in the morning at night. And at this point she no longer walked. I did get her walking for a little bit, but we put a commode bedside. And so while she sat on the commode, I soaked her feet in Epsom salt and washed her hair and rinsed the hair. And that was a journey because I covered it with towels and everything. But boy, it was like I was pouring acid on her head. Ooh, and I'm going, come on, it's warm water. Anyway, she loved the results, but the process was not so cool. And then when she was finished on the commode, I gave her like a full body massage, and then new diaper. She picked out the wardrobe, and then I blow dried her hair when she was in the wheelchair. Don't do that on the commode, near water. Anyway, she, and then I would put her hair. At this point, her hair was very long for a year. It was long when she was young, and then she had the six kids, and it got shorter and became this little perm thing. And now it was long again. It was beautiful. And I grew up with three sisters with long hair. So I learned a lot of things other than put the toilet seat down. And so I used those things and I blow dried her hair and put it in a ponytail. Sometimes I braided it for brownie points. And then got her. Oh, then I did her nails. And then I topped it off with a bright red lipstick to match her bright red nails. And I just thought it was a nice thing to do, no big deal. So I put her in the wheelchair and then we wheeled her into the kitchen for breakfast. And as we're passing through the dining room, there's a big mirror in the dining room. And I parked her in front of that mirror. And she's just staring at herself. And I leaned in. I said, "Who's that pretty girl?" And she just beamed. And I said, "Oh my gosh, when is the last time she looked in a mirror? And then when's the last time she looked in the mirror and liked what she saw? And when's the last time she felt beautiful?" But she did that day. And it was amazing. And it just had a profound effect on me as well. I mean, for her, it was infectious because everybody who saw her, now she's, you know, feeling great. And it was a lovely, a simple gesture, a lovely thing to do, but I didn't think that much of it. But boy, the realization of wanting to feel pretty doesn't end with age.
It's, you know, dignity, and right? It's giving her back the dignity and the ability to do that for herself just by looking at herself in the mirror. She didn't have to do to go to the salon herself. She didn't have to do those things herself. But it's such an amazing, the fact that she was on her deathbed and went and lasted for years with you shows the dignity and the difference in what she felt and what she, what she was able to still get in quality of life during that time. It's just such a, it's such a cool story. I love this so much. Okay. Tell me how you came to the title of a couple on the commode.
All right. So we hinted that a little bit. So we had the commode bedside, right? And so sometimes Mother Nature took a little longer than it was comfortable for either one of us. And kind of as a silly gesture, one day, her favorite beverage was a cup of hot tea, skim milk, and no sugar. So I just said, "Hey, you want a cup of tea while you're sitting there?" She goes, "Sure." I made her a cup of tea. And so that became, it was a hit. And that became our morning ritual. Cup of tea in the commode. And that just came out of the writing. You know, I'm writing the book and I had another title in mind. And then when I thought about this, I said, well, it's such a practical thing and catchy.
Very. You have no doubt that you want to read the book by the title because it,
oh, good.
Just 1 second. I have to know more about this story. I have
Oh,
to.
Good. Because I had one reader who, she's actually, hopes she's not deaf, but she did admit she's blind. And so she read this in Braille. I have no idea it was in Braille or how she did it, but and she wrote this thing. She goes, "I was put off by the title, but I'm so glad I read the book." And then it was glowing after that. So that was the only one that admitted that the title actually put her off a little bit. But yeah, everybody seems to get a kick out of it. And so, yeah, it was lovely. So actually, I'm looking for tea companies. Mom's, it was Lipton Tea. So I'm going to contact the Lipton Tea Company and say, "Listen, I got Tetley on the other line here. You want to jump in? Because we can inspire a lot of people to do, you know, jump into caregiving and drink your tea. And I got a way to do it." So I don't know. We'll see. We'll have to do some cross promotions.
I love it. Collaboration for sure. I see it in the future. I really want to get your take in this last few minutes that we're going to talk on the grieving process while someone is here. That there is to me, a process that we go through while we're watching someone decline. And that is different than the process that happens when they're no longer here. Talk us through how you felt during that process and how it shifted along the timeline.
Well, our journey, I call it a journey and adventure, was 3.5 years. And I think I pushed that aside. But the other thing that I did with the dignity issue was I wanted to return dignity to her surroundings. So I renovated the house. Mom slept a lot, like a baby, during the day. She was a night owl. I ended up putting a baby monitor in her room because after I had my bedroom upstairs And so I had a video monitor in case she needed to call or something. I didn't want to miss running to her aid. And she would have these conversations. She had a little bit of dementia and stuff, but she was a night owl. She worked the night shift for 30 years at the newspaper. So she was used to being a night owl. And I'm a bit of a night owl, as we'll see later on tonight. I would watch. It was better than anything on TV. My gosh, the conversation she was having with whoever, and fidgeting and stuff like that was amazing. Anyway, so I originally got that when I was renovating because I'd be in the basement and she'd be up in her room, and I wanted to make sure if she needed something, I could run up. I think the grieving process was tearing the damn house apart. I put it into, luckily, into something positive, but there were some good stress relief in ripping down old beams and paneling and the past of that house, because again, the house was pretty run down at that point. And so that certainly, I didn't realize it at the time. I was doing it kind of as, to renovate the house, but also some stress relief. But I didn't think of it as grieving until, you're writing the book and you're going, yeah, of course I was grieving. Because when my dad, 14 years earlier, my dad passed, and I only had 8 days with him. And during that time, I ripped up the upstairs bathroom and was retiling. And I was keeping him updated on all the, I said, here are the new fixtures I'm putting in, and here's the tiling I'm putting in. And it was, again, at the time, I didn't think about it, but you go, yeah, that was the grieving. So I put the grieving. So I said, if you want to get your house renovated, call me up and give me a sad story. I'll go in and start fixing things, I guess. But out of that, it was pretty funny. So I kept mom, again, this is where some of the humor comes in. So again, I kept mom abreast, and she'd be sitting in her big motorized reclining chair in the living room watching the Pet Channel almost all the time. And I'd be going in and out with 2x4s. Luckily, a Home Depot wasn't far away. And so I'm carrying materials down to the basement, and she's watching every day going, what is going on down there? And I said, I'm renovating your house. I'm making it beautiful again. She goes, well, who's paying for all that? I said, you are. So cheer up because you may have to go back to work. And we would have this conversation almost every day for a number of days. But luckily, every time I went to Home Depot, she liked McDonald's smoothies. I would pick up a smoothie, so she got a bonus. So she'd be sucking on the straw, watching me go by with 2x4s, going, "What is going on?" But she didn't complain. So the basement was the first thing I finished, and I did put a man cave there for stress relief also. And so I knew that the breaking, taking the breaks was important. So I finished the basement. I had her pick out the paint colors and things like that. I mean, I did nudge her a little bit, but for the carpet samples. I served her breakfast, and on her breakfast tray, I put two of the carpet samples. That was the final thing we had to pick out. And I go to refill her sippy cup with juice, and I come back in. She's got one of the carpet samples in her mouth with a scowl on her face. And she goes, this is not a cookie. I said, no, mom, it's a carpet sample for the basement. Which one tastes better? And she chose well. So we had a lovely, it was, a tan textured tweed thing. So it could have looked like a cookie, I guess, if you're 80 or 90 something at that point. And then I did this, not her floor, but the upstairs, and completely redid the bathroom. The bathroom with six kids, it was a girl side and a boy side. So I completely opened that up, and it was like a 100 square foot bathroom. And so I put a huge tub. Put a separate shower and a huge tub and radiant floors. It was gorgeous. I had, again, my design and my background. I was pretty good at construction and stuff like that. So I put this huge bathtub, and asked mom if she wanted to christen the bathtub with a bubble bath. Again, this is the guy taking the romantic approach with mom. So I carry her upstairs, And I put her in the bubble bath, and I have the bubbles neatly covering things. And I shot a picture, and she's beaming again, just the biggest smile from ear to ear. And then she passes out in the tub. And I'm like, oh my God, I try to do a good thing and I kill my mom. But at least she smelled good. So I thought, and not all bad. But how am I going to explain this to my siblings? So I thought she was joking because again, she had a sense of humor that was a little dark at times. And I'm like, Mom, come on, Mom, come on. So I get her out of the tub, I carry her downstairs and put her to bed, and then call up a nurse. And the nurse says, you left her in the hot water too long, and her blood pressure just went down. She fainted. So I stayed with her. She woke up about a half hour later, had no recollection of fainting. But did love the new bathroom. So it was a win-win for Mark.
That was a very, very big win for Mark, for sure.
Luckily, because I can imagine I'm writing a book and I said, oh, by the way, that's how mom died. And they go, oh, anyway. So,
Way you deliver your information to us. It just, I can't help but laugh. And what I love the most about everything that you share is how much love I can hear in the story. Not just for your mom, but for the house that you grew up in, for the process that you were going through, even though it was not simple, it was not easy, it was emotionally taxing. The love that you present the story with is just such a cool, it gives me hope. And that is absolutely the message that I want to leave us with, is that even in a hard situation, even in a position of knowing what the end result will be, you still were able to bring humor and hope and love to a situation that was incredibly difficult. And that is my favorite part of the story.
cool. And she did too. There was one night when I got her, I just finishing getting her ready for bed. So I'm just a bit, I did the baby powder, the bath, just about to tape her diaper, and she starts peeing on me. And I think it's cute for a baby to pee on a new parent, not when it's your 90-year-old mother. So I go, oh, Mom, why? I was just about done. She says, she looks at me and she goes, it's natural. And you're going, how can you be mad at this? So I just started all over again. It's like it was, so she was great also. And there's a lot more funny things, stories and things that she said and other stuff in the book. Because people say that, I say you get to cry out loud and you laugh out loud too. And that's, I mean, that's life. But luckily, I had a lovely set of parents, and my siblings are all a little wacky too. And it was, humor plays a big role in my life always. And so, in this particular instance, it was vital, I would say.
Love it. How can we find you? How can we find your book? How can we find your anything else that you're doing in this wonderful world that we live in? Where can we find you?
Well, if anybody Googles a cup of tea on the commode, it's everywhere. Certainly on Amazon. Amazon has the paperback, the large print paperback, the ebook, and also the audiobook, and a bunch of other. And Barnes and Noble has a few of them. I don't think they have all of them. Amazon, unless you're an anti-Amazon person, but Amazon has it. There's a lot of brick and mortar stores. My distributor has them in stores all over the world. We're currently actually going after foreign rights for the book to get it in some other languages, because it's a universal story and it's timely and timeless. Unless you have mother issues,
And
so.
even still, I feel like this book can heal some of that if you're able to move through. So, and I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I agree. I think there are
I had somebody, I did. I got a YouTube channel with about 170 something short videos, and that most of them are pretty entertaining. And so one of them, I said, if you don't have mother issues, you'll love this book. And one, I don't know her, but she's originally from my hometown. She contacted me and said, "I have mother issues and I loved your book." So it helped her maybe get over it. I'm not sure, but yeah, so that was a nice thing to hear, because some of the critics and the reviewers and the readers have been just really generous with their comments and their it's won, I think, over 13 awards so far. I just got another one this week. So that's nice. That's pretty cool for your first book.
That's pretty cool for any book, but yeah, absolutely.
So
Absolutely.
those are fun. But the personal notes I've received, especially from my hometown, I haven't been in touch with these people for over 50 years. And it seems like half of them are on Facebook, because I keep getting suggestions from Ridgewood, New Jersey, all the time. And it's like, oh yeah, let's sign up. Let's go. I'm actually doing a Zoom event with the public library in Ridgewood in a couple of weeks. So that'll be kind of fun. Yeah, so their support has been lovely, because a lot of the town in my family, which is lovely, because some people again have memories of my parents. I didn't know how close they were and stuff, but this, oh yeah, your dad was my baseball coach. Oh yeah, I remember your mom did this and this, and it was like these are lovely. So doing these interviews and talking about this book is what I say is your gift to me, because it keeps my mom in the present. And she was a very cool lady, and I love sharing her with the world. And so it's nice.
I love it. And that's on that note, I want to say thank you for being here. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your honesty and for your incredible storytelling. I don't think I've ever laughed as much as I've laughed in this episode. So I really appreciate all of those things. Thank you so much for being a part of
Well, it was my pleasure. Thank you. I'm glad you laughed.
it.